From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 243 with guest Todd LaMoth, recorded Tuesday, November 29th, 2011. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. You're listening to Run As Radio, and with me today is Todd LaMoth, and we just saw each other a little while ago. Where was it? Toronto at Tech Days.
That's right.
And you were doing a great session that I thought more people need to know about, which was securing Wi-Fi in a little bit more than just a web password.
So yeah, that's right. I was using Active Directory as more of the authentication mechanism and using a certificate to kind of protect the Wi-Fi.
Okay, so not just straight up. I mean, obviously, encrypting Wi-Fi is a good idea.
That's right.
So any particular preference? You like WPA2, PSK, anything like that?
WPA2, and then in the case of the presentation I was using, we're using the enterprise version. It says PSK, which is a passphrase that you just put a password on like you use at home.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, we're using enterprise edition of it, which uses Active Directory to verify that the person connecting to the Wi-Fi has Active Directory credentials.
All right, so then we're literally talking individual unique authentications for each user on your Wi-Fi.
That's right.
So what do I need to stamp? Hey, there's this particular kind of Wi-Fi. Not every access point is going to have this feature, right?
That's right. Most of them now seem to have them, but not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of the 802.1x standard. It's something that we're doing as a rollout here at the school board.
Mm-hmm.
We've got 100 locations and almost 30,000 students, and we're planning on our next gen wireless to actually have every student would authenticate onto the Wi-Fi with their device. A lot of kids, we have a lot of bring your own device, with kids bringing in cell phones and iPads and iPods.
Of course, you want to let them do it, but you want them to be, the nice thing about authenticating them uniquely like that is, I mean, you clearly know who was doing what.
That's right. Exactly. We know who's on. And then with our next generation firewall, we're actually able to use that authentication mechanism that we authenticated them on the Wi-Fi. We then know who's going out to the firewall.
Right, right. I mean, that's a huge asset because Wi-Fi is such an exposure, essentially, people sharing passwords and things like that. You know.
When you have it with a shared password like we have now, we have no idea who's done what.
Right.
We know that somebody on Wi-Fi was with this IP address was going out and doing something that maybe they shouldn't have been doing.
And it's a DHCP served address, so it could be anybody. Those things change all the time.
That's right.
So if I'm messing around with my access point, I want to know if I have the support for this. Is this particularly WPA2? Is it called Enterprise or Radius? Or
WPA2 Enterprise. There is. Sometimes you'll see Radius in there as well. There was different versions. I know originally you'll see people talk about 802.1x, and sometimes that tends to be like a generic term for it. But in some cases on some access points, that tends to mean WEP encryption with enterprise credentials, which we want to try and stay away from WEP as much as possible.
Right.
Because that's very easily broken.
Yeah, it's old, let's face
it. It's old.
Yeah. There's no WPA seems to be, and WPA2 seems to be the way.
That's right.
It's just, I think most part, people are just using the pre-shared key model.
That's right.
So this is Enterprise and Radius the same thing?
Yes, pretty much. I mean, that's a lot of times that you'll see it's interchangeable.
Okay.
From what I've done from research and stuff.
So first off, access point that understands this concept of enterprise.
That's right. So first thing you need is an access point that can handle it.
Mm-hmm.
On that access point, you're going to point it to a Radius server. In my environment, what I've done is I've done a couple of things. One is created a Radius server using network protection services on Windows Server 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So create an NPS server, set it up for Radius authentication, and then set up the access point to be a Radius client. And then on there, you're going to set up the Radius for authentication however you want to do it. You can do it. You can do this two ways. One of them is to use machine certificates for verifying who is on your network. So you can have each device, to be able to connect to your wireless, would have to have a machine certificate that would say, yeah, this device is authenticated to be on the wireless.
But that means you have to touch every
device.
That's
right. And with in our environment where we have potentially, we're, you know, if a kid brings two devices to school, that's 60,000 devices that
right.
we have to kind of touch to give them a certificate. That's not going to work.
Yeah. And every device, especially when you have talking about a bring your own hardware environment.
Yeah.
Every device is going to be touched differently too. In fact, aren't there certain devices that aren't going to be able to be compliant with this? I've found limited support for different modes of Wi-Fi on certain devices.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it could potentially be a little more complicated. And how do you get certificates on all the machines and these different devices? I mean, we got everything from Android to iPad, you know, iOS devices.
Sure.
We've got some Windows Phone devices as well. And all kinds of different hardware's out there.
Yeah.
So, it's amazing. So.
Yeah, it just sounds like a non-starter.
That's right. So using the username password, you basically, it kind of allows you to have, you only need to generate one, so you need to have certificates as well involved in this. So by having, you can either use your own certificate authority internally,
mm-hmm.
which is great. However, things like bring your own device, they're not going to necessarily trust your enterprise root authority. So the way of getting around that is you go to somebody like a VeriSign or an Entrust, and you talk with them and you get a certificate for your NPS server from them. Now that enterprise root is, most of them, the big ones are trusted on the devices themselves.
You only need to do this one time.
That's right. You do it one time. You go get the certificate.
Mm-hmm.
You generate it. You bring it on. You install it on your NPS server. And now when you're, it's basically for when you send your username and password across the wire, you want to make sure that's encrypted.
Right.
So that certificate is used to encrypt those credentials.
Right.
To make sure that, you know, because sending them in plain text kind of defeats the purpose.
Well, and this is the whole PKA model, and you're encrypting it. The only person who can decrypt it is someone with the other half of that cert.
That's right.
So that's fairly secure. And, I you just hit me with such a key thing here, which is people now think differently about logging into Wi-Fi as soon as they're giving up their personal credentials to be able to log in.
That's right.
Like, you know, I know it's you. It was your account that logged in, and this is the log of your actions there.
That's right.
So the Radius services is built into AD. Do I have to install it separately? Where does it come from?
You're going to install it separate. So you're going to install NPS on a box. You can, in my environment, the way we're doing it is we have our AD boxes. They're, the main controllers are off to the one side. We're going to bring up, some boxes for NPS. We're probably going to bring up at least two or three that'll be able to handle kind of because the access points, you can put multiple servers in.
Yeah.
It makes it really straightforward. We don't have to worry about load balancing or setting up any kind of load balancing whatnot. We're just going to point them at the three and put them in order and set them. If the first one's down, try the second one. Second one's down, go on to the third. So
right.
We're going to do it that way. And so you're going to install basically the NPS role with Windows Server 2008, bring it up, install the Radius role, configure it for whatever authentication mechanism you want to use. In my case, I'm using EAP and then setting up there's a thing called PEEP within that for setting up the username and password. And once you have that going, you have to define where your Radius controllers or your access points are going to be. So Radius clients, they are called. You set those up. Once you have that defined, you're pretty much off to the races.
All right, Todd, you ripped out a lot of acronyms there, so let's back up a few. First one was NPS.
Right, NPS, and I'm probably calling that one wrong, but it's Network Policy Server is what it stands for.
Okay, so this is how your network has policies pushed out. It's just it's a role in 2008 server.
That's right, and it was what was originally in, I think, 2003 IAS, and I don't know what that acronym was again.
Internet Authentication Services.
That's right. So it became NPS in 2008.
Right.
And yeah, so you set that up with Radius.
As opposed to Radius being Remote Authentication Dial-In User Service, which is a really old acronym.
Right. I didn't even know it standing for that. I just knew it was Radius and never knew it was an acronym.
It always is. But you realize, I mean, that was literally the service we were using when people were dialing up into our offices. That's how old Radius is.
Right.
And just don't do that anymore. And I think NPS is a far better name. But you also mentioned EAP.
EAP, which is Extensible Authentication Protocol.
Okay, EAP.
Yeah.
And so that is a configuration mode in NPS for how you want to do the securing.
That's right.
And does Network Access Protection, does NAP play a role in all of this?
I'm not using it in my environment, but you can set it up, and I think you can have the machines do a health check before they're allowed on to your network. But
right.
I'm not sure what clients are allowed, what clients work with that. I mean, we're talking about a lot of handheld devices here, iPads and Mac devices and all kinds of different things. And how are we going to be able to do a health check on some of these devices is going to be a bit of a
Yeah, an iPad's not going to help you there. I mean, the big thing with NAP is because it ties into DHCP. It's this idea of different access pools and different access rights based on your ability to authenticate the state of the machine. But,
right.
But that's just to get connectivity. You're talking a different thing here entirely by actually being able to log in.
That's right. So in order to get connected to the wireless, they're going to use their username, password, connect.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we've just closed an RFP for our next gen firewall here at the school board.
Mm-hmm.
We selected Palo Alto. Originally, a device sat sort of on the edge, and it protected the internal organization from the internet and, you know, that sort of thing. We're planning on moving this piece so that it's more central so that, you know, as data comes off our wireless, it's going to hit the firewall.
Right.
Okay, you're trying to go where now? Well, you're so-and-so, and you're trying to hit the data center. Well, why are you trying to access a back-end SharePoint server?
Right. And you're in a school setting, so you've got students as well as administrators and teachers. So
that's right.
Clearly, students probably don't have access to the data center.
That's right. And for most things, I don't think there's really a need for them. They mostly need to get on the internet.
Right.
They do have to access their file shares,
mm-hmm.
which are located in our data center, but that's really it.
Right.
They don't have a lot of needs for, you know, getting into SQL servers and that sort of stuff.
And we already have this. I mean, the expensive part here is you're still giving everybody an AD account, but you already have that commitment anyway. This is
that's
not,
right.
You didn't do this for Wi-Fi.
No, that's right. Everybody has an AD account. They have an email address. They have a login to get on the machines. I mean, every student needs to get on the computers to do their work, whether it be Word or Excel or whatever it is that they're doing. Everybody has a computer account or
right.
a login in AD. So it's already there. It's just a matter of we're leveraging that account they already have to now tie them to their to the wireless. And what the benefit we're actually getting from it is right now is as a student comes in with his device, he gets a guest profile for his wireless device.
Mm-hmm.
That also includes a web filtering policy.
Right, probably a fairly strict one at this point.
Very strict, because we don't know who it is, whether it's a young junior student
mm-hmm.
or is it a high school student. Or is it a teacher?
Right.
We don't know. So we have to give them the most restrictive policy.
Mm-hmm.
By then using their username and password, we can then hit the firewall and say, oh, hey, it's so-and-so. Oh, that's a high school student. They're allowed a little more.
Yeah.
So we can open things up a little bit.
So maybe we're talking Facebook. I think I would not allow Facebook access on an unauthenticated user.
That's right.
And then as soon as you're authenticated and I know you're, you know, over the age of 13, which is actually Facebook's policy as much as anything else, but whatever your school's policy is,
that's
you're
right.
a teenager, fine, we'll let you into Facebook.
I mean,
there's a strong incentive for them to actually go through the authentication process.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I can't remember what our certain policies are on certain things, but
mm-hmm.
social media, but yeah, it's something sort of along those lines where we have, I know there's some, I think YouTube is one of the things that we allow for high school, but not younger students.
Right.
And so there's a potential. You want to make sure you want to give a carrot to them to be able to use their login credentials.
Right.
So that's important.
Well, and again, you know, having dealt with internet safety issues in schools as a parent and as an expert helping out, you know, the fact that we could authenticate who was logged in as whom and is a pretty big deal. That's pretty useful. And just the, you know, that recognition of there is no anonymity here.
That's right.
We know who you are and what you're doing.
I mean, I'm new to the school board. I started in July of 2011.
Mm-hmm.
But before in my past life, when you guys talked to me last time, I was working with the County of Lenox and Addington, which was libraries and museums.
Right.
And unfortunately, in that role, I've had a few incidents where I was called as a witness for the police because they had issues with what some of our patrons were doing in the library on the internet. So
yeah, I bet.
I mean, at schools, we have it. You hear all the time about cyberbullying and all kinds of different issues. So being able to see who's been on doing stuff is definitely helps us out.
Yeah, just in a sense of being a responsible member of the community.
That's right.
We're going to provide internet access to our students. We have to live under certain sets of rules.
That's right.
But the interesting side of this is it doesn't seem like I need a lot of, this is not a very high end access point. I just double checked my old, 54G, my Cisco, the cheap one that you put DDWRT on, supports it, no problem. You know, that's a $50 router.
That's right.
And no special networking gear, standard 2008. It looks like if you can run AD, which you can run on anything, like small business server,
and you
buy one of these routers, you've got all the ingredients to have individually user-identified access.
That's right. I mean, the toughest part is probably getting the certificate.
Right.
And I ran into some troubles just in getting ready for Tech Days was I went to GoDaddy and got myself a computer certificate from them.
Mm-hmm.
What it has to be, the computer certificate that's generated has to be tied directly to the enterprise root for the device to trust it.
Okay.
Is what I've discovered.
So, and what does that mean to be tied to the enterprise root?
It means that the certificate should be issued directly from the enterprise root. And all I know is that in our environment corporately here, we have an enterprise root, we have an intermediate root.
Mm-hmm.
So we generate an intermediate root from the enterprise root. From the intermediate root, we generate a certificate for the issuing server.
Right.
So there's a whole chain. And apparently what I've discovered in kind of my, in trying to make it work and see why I was getting some errors with the devices saying, hey, we see the certificate. We know it's from so-and-so, but we don't trust GoDaddy. We don't know GoDaddy's not trusted. I thought, well, I'm looking at my device. There's definitely a GoDaddy enterprise root certificate on here.
Right.
But because they'd issue it through their intermediate, the radio server we have to send out two certificates.
So this was GoDaddy's mistake then?
Well, not so much as GoDaddy's mistake. It's actually my mistake.
You ordered the wrong kind of cert.
I ordered the wrong kind of cert.
Right.
And so what I actually was talking to a few fellows in a different conference in Ottawa, and we were talking about it. I said, yeah, Todd, what you want to do is you need a certificate that's issued straight off the enterprise. There's a few companies that do that. VeriSign is definitely one of them.
Right.
I went and looked it up. A certificate is a lot more money than what I'm going to pay from GoDaddy, but it's going to work.
Yeah,
that's sort of the price you pay for.
Well, we have this interesting problem, and we've done shows around this about, in general, the fact that they've broadened the certificate authority market so wide, and there are levels of authentication, levels of quality, and levels of recognition depending on the technology. So
that's right.
For better or worse, sometimes we have to go back to NetSol and pay their premium.
Yeah.
But that's good advice to certainly be very sure. And I'd hate to say it. I mean, I've used GoDaddy certs too, but I've also had to refund them because I got the wrong ones.
Yeah.
And I to give them credit, you know, kudos for this, GoDaddy. When I called you and said I got the wrong cert, I set it up wrong, you just refunded my money.
They were great with me. I had a couple of things were just some growing pains in getting the things going. And yeah, they were really good for helping me out.
Yeah. No, I like that. Even when they're not the right shop, but they, you know, good service will take you a long way. And the whole certificate thing is really a hard part of making this stuff right.
Yeah.
Frustrating.
This section of Run As Radio is sponsored by Secret Server, the password management software for IT admins. Secret Server helps you manage local admin passwords and service accounts the right way. Get your free 30-day trial for Secret Server at runasradio.com/secret-server.
I want to jump back onto EAP again just to talk about the different modes and so forth, but let's just go back over the chain. So I've got my Wi-Fi access point. It's configured in WPA2 Radius or WPA2 Enterprise. I'm now pointing that at my Radius server, which is just a service installed on Windows 2008. And then what are the next steps? Because now we have to put the certificate into it, right? And you wanted an enterprise root cert.
So, right. So you're going to go and generate a request for a computer certificate request. And I call them a CSR. And I'm not sure that's another acronym that is that's out there. But if you generate a CSR, you run the cert request tool, and you're going to need to make sure you have a template for the certificate that you're going to need. For me, it was a matter of going online and searching for a template that already existed for a Radius box. I got that template, generated the CSR, which in turn allowed me to have basically the code that I need to go to a company's website. Like, for example, I went to GoDaddy, pasted in the code that I received from the CSR.
Mm-hmm.
That in turn generated the certificate. You download the certificate. You would then open up your MMC console, and it's the certificates add-ins, or snap-in, they call it.
Yeah.
And then import that computer certificate into the machine.
Yeah, and if you've ever set up SSL on a web server, the whole CSR, the certificate signing request and stuff, this is a normal process.
That's right.
Nothing magical here. The only thing I thought was important is you really want one of the enterprise root certificate authorities here.
That's right. You need to research, and you're looking for one that does, I've seen them done as different names, but I think, you know, they're either Wi-Fi certificates, or sometimes they're called WLAN certificates, or RADIUS certificates, but that's the one you want. You don't want just like a general computer certificate.
Right.
Which is what I went and got. And that won't work. So
now, how does EAP come into the equation here?
When you're configuring the authentication mechanism for how your machines or your users are going to authenticate, you set up what that authentication is going to be. So in our case, we want to use the EAP MS CHAP version 2.
Right. And I think MS CHAP is old school too.
It's old school, but that's the PEAP, Protected Authentication or Extensible Authenticated Protocol.
Yeah.
Acronym soup. I hate out of the acronyms.
You gotta wade your way through that. You're gonna make choices here in drop down, so you better know one from the other.
Well, that's right, yeah. So, you know, you're gonna use the PEAP to make your connection back and forth so the username and password work.
Okay.
And just going back to the certificate piece, when I did this presentation in Toronto, I had a lot of people come back to me after the session and they said, yeah, we got this going back in our own environment. It works great. But we all use self-sign. I think everybody who walked over to me said, yeah, we didn't bother paying for a certificate. We went with self-sign certificate. And I said, okay, well, why did you guys choose that? In most cases, it was expensive. We could use our own self-sign certificate and it worked awesome. The only thing is when you have devices coming up prompting you and saying, this certificate's untrusted, do you trust it? That's really where it boils down to.
And how expensive are we talking here? I thought it was maybe a couple $100.
I think the one I saw at VeriSign was running about $500 for the year.
You know, the counterpoint to this is, how much does each tech support call to say, yes, you can say okay for an unsafe cert?
That's right.
You know, that's the math. You're talking about 60,000 potential devices. Like, once you're at 10 calls, you've paid for the cert.
Well, that's right. And if the devices are not domain joined, there's a whole load of steps and whatnot that you have to walk through a Windows machine. Because a Windows machine will not come up and say, hey, this certificate's not trusted.
Right.
It just won't let you connect.
Yeah, just no. Bye.
Bye. There's something wrong with the cert.
Yeah.
I'm out of here.
Yeah.
I'm not even trying to connect. There's
sure.
just something totally wrong here. There's a whole series of steps that you need to walk through to basically make this thing want to connect onto this environment.
$500 to save grief is not that expensive.
I mean, I'm talking about 60,000 potential support calls.
Yeah, that's expensive.
That's expensive. very expensive. I'm going to have to like triple or quadruple my help desk.
Sure. Yeah. No, you'll interesting how, and an interesting consideration when you're trying to do the ROI on a new technology like this of what the help desk cost incurred will be if I mishandle this.
That's right.
You know, you definitely one of these things where I bent down to pick up a penny and a whole lot of dollar bills sailed over my head.
Yeah.
So, the EAP with MS CHAP allows you to authenticate back to the Active Directory.
That's right. And then, of course, the RADIUS server has me a member of AD.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that goes without saying, but just as something to point out.
Wouldn't you typically run the RADIUS server right on a domain controller?
You might be able to. I've just thought separating the roles out, especially in our corporate environment. As I'm mirroring this and doing my demos, I'm trying to mirror how would I do this in my own production environment here at the board. So you probably could run it right on your own AD box. I'm not sure what the limitations are of RADIUS and whatnot.
Okay, and typically a virtual machine here. This is still a fairly specialized machine.
That's right. I mean, I'm running all this stuff in VMs.
Right.
None of this will be running on physical boxes.
Yeah, it's all network communications.
That's right.
And as far as redundancy is concerned?
As far as redundancy is concerned, I'm going to run three of these boxes, and what my access points will all do, at least allow me to put in two IP addresses.
Right.
So that's how I'm getting around it. You can run network load balancing and probably load balance the things, but for me, I can do it with just IP addresses on the access points. So if one's down, try the other one.
Yeah.
And we've actually internally hit the board. We went out and bought Aruba's equipment, so we're sitting on a pile of that, and it actually lets you create in the configuration something called a server group, which is just a group of servers, and you just put your Radius server, you point it to the group, which then tries all the different servers in the object that are, have objects created for them. So it's really simple for us to just deploy them, set them up independently, and the access points really will do some of the load balancing for you.
Now we get into the intelligence around the Wi-Fi side itself, because when you're talking about that many devices distributed over that wide an area, actual infrastructure Wi-Fi is its own concern.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
And probably a whole other show if we were going to dig into it at any substantial level. Give us a quick 5-minute. What do you focus on as far as building a proper mesh of Wi-Fi access points?
Well, what we're actually walking through right now, I'm actually the project manager here at the board for doing the Wi-Fi rollout. And we've got 2,500 access points right now that we're going to be deploying across the across all the board schools.
Mm-hmm.
We're using an RF planner, so a planning software. It takes a map of our school in AutoCAD and brings it in, and then we start deploying. It basically tells us, gives us good recommendations for access points, and then we look at our map and say, well, that's a bathroom, so we're not going to put one in there. and this is a library, so we actually know we're going to have a higher density of students with devices in that area.
Right.
This is the cafeteria. We're going to see a higher density in the cafeteria, especially during lunchtime. So
yep.
We know we have to add access points. It automatically figures out, you know, what channels these things should be on, what the optimal power level should be for these things. So the planning for that is done. Then you have to actually have these things on your network. So you're planning the IP structure.
Right.
And then also have to hand each of the devices an IP address.
And are you handing out 10 dots?
We're handing out 10 dots, yeah.
Yeah. Do you lock down a particular B? How are you subdividing everything?
We have right now, the way it's set up is the school is set up as a B class.
Mm-hmm.
Each school has its own B class network.
Right.
And that's sort of what's available.
You're around 60,000 devices per school then?
That's right. I mean, I don't think our subnet masks are that big. I think we're running about 1,000 devices.
Right.
Per subnet mask.
But anything over 200 and it might as well be 50,000.
Well, that's right. Yeah. Because and that's what we're trying to figure out. How can we want to lock that down a little bit, because from last generation to new generation, we know that if you have too many devices wirelessly broadcasting all the time,
yeah.
Now everybody's fighting for that broadcast. And you want to try and limit that.
Mm-hmm.
There is a concern, though, where if we have, say, we're going to plan for 2,000 devices in a school at 255 IP addresses, that's approximately 8 subnets that we're going to need.
Right.
Certain brands of devices to print, and I'm going to call out it's Apple and their AirPrint system, the devices have to be on the same subnet mask as the printer.
Right.
To print. So how do you assure that an iPad gets the same IP range as that printer that's sitting in that room?
Yeah, good luck.
Because there's no guarantee that they'll hit the same access point.
No.
Kid could be on the other side of the classroom. They're getting better coverage from the access point in a different room.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're trying to keep the signal strength pretty low.
Yeah.
We're trying to provide a better density, but we're trying not to have too strong a signal because we want to provide a better throughput. We're not just trying to put it in blast mode and cover the area. We're trying to actually give a good throughput. And by doing that, you actually lower your signal strength.
Interesting. Yeah. To create smaller pools of good connectivity around them.
That's right. Yeah.
The CERT, once a guy's established a connection this way, as he hops access points, his tokens just move along. There's no visible bump as he switches.
That's right. So because our controllers are centralized, everything goes back to the controller.
Right.
And so if, when he moves from one access point to another access point, the controller still sees them
right.
And says, okay, he's moved on to this one.
Yeah, and the IP carries across because DHCP is in the same situation. So
that's
forth.
Right. So it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Now, in the olden days, when you had multiple access points set up that were all standalone, you had what was called nomadic roaming, where you basically tore down the whole connection
and rebuilt
to the new access point and rebuilt.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's two different discussions here. One is this a more sophisticated way to authenticate users onto your Wi-Fi, which I think is great. And then the whole other conversation of building a proper infrastructure Wi-Fi versus a nomadic Wi-Fi.
That's right.
Which are all important discussions and perhaps one we'll have to have another day.
Yeah.
Todd, it's always good fun to talk to you. I really appreciate your insights into this. I have not explored, you know, Radius to me is so old. It's sort of a dated dial-up technology, but it's nice to see it being used for good.
Yeah. It's nice. It works well. And everything's built right into Windows Server, which is awesome.
Yeah, you already own it.
You already own it. There's no having to go out and have to license anything new.
And Do we have a guest mode? Do we have an option if someone doesn't have an account, what we can do with them?
We do with the, there's many ways to tackle it. One is you could say, you know what, here, we'll give you, we have a passphrase that's available to you.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a passphrase again on the guest. That's one way of doing it.
So sort of a mixed mode, either fully authenticate or here's a regular passphrase and then you get sort of the limited privileges.
That's right. Another way of doing it is also having, with the Aruba stuff, they have a process called Amigapod. And the way that works is you would say, I want to get on your wireless. Here's my cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
Text message me my username and password to get on.
No, and does it actually go and pump an account into AD for you?
It will create an account on the controller.
Okay.
So then they have basically a guest access on the controller. And how we decide to use it, we could then say, you know what, this is a guest device. We're actually going to send them out a different internet connection from our main internet connection.
Right.
We have a lot of different options on how we can to handle that.
And as far, you know, we started this whole conversation with the relationship and logging, right? That now that I have that person authenticated, I know who was issued that IP address. What about logging? How much information can I really assemble about someone, if the police should come knocking?
You can get quite a bit. I mean, it's going to depend on most likely your firewall.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have that piece now that's collecting and basically knows who, depending on the technology, knows this IP address access this
right.
information.
So it starts with the radius log itself saying this account got with this IP address logged in at this time and expired at that time. And you take that time window and associate it with the firewall log for traffic for a given IP.
That's right. That's one way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
When our RFP went with the Palo Alto device as our firewall, mm-hmm. next-gen firewall, it has a user identification service where it ties the user ID. So we're actually, one of the ways we're looking at doing this is that we're going to send auths and deauths from the radius, authentication. So the controller is going to send the auth and deauth over to a syslog server.
Right.
Kiwi, I think, is what we're going to use.
Mm-hmm.
But there's many different ones you could use. There's then a Perl script that runs on that box, looking at the logs. Every time it sees an auth and deauth, or most importantly an auth, it's going to say this user logged in on this IP.
Right.
Forwards it to
the firewall.
The firewall's authentication service,
mm-hmm.
which then forwards it to the firewall. So now the firewall knows, hey, I know this IP address. It's so and so.
Right.
Out she goes. So we can look
to the point there. That means the firewall's not going to let them out until that process works.
That's right.
And it may be only a fraction of a second.
That's right.
But it is part of your login procedure is now the firewall in the firewall logs has the user authenticated.
I can go to one spot to look to
right.
see where everything has happened instead of having to go across multiple spots in my network to figure out where, if I have to go to my Windows box and see who logged in,
yeah.
look at DHCP to see where MAC address.
Yeah.
If I have to go through all that process, or I can just go to one spot and mm-hmm. say, okay, who was on this IP address and where were they going?
Right.
And show me everything that they did.
Well, and it's because typically if you're going to deal with an incident, it's going to start with this external IP address on these dates.
That's right.
And, this time span. And you start at the firewall. So the fact that everything's already sitting at the firewall means you're all the way to the end game immediately.
That's right.
And hopefully that doesn't, well, we're all IT pros here, so that doesn't chill us too much with the big brother. Ultimately, these are responsibilities we have when we're dealing with the networks.
That's right. It's part of our... one of the things we signed up for.
Yep, it's one of the obligations.
Yep.
Todd, great to talk to you. I think we should do that Wi-Fi architecture discussion sooner than later.
Okay.
Appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks a lot.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.